91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour begins with a focus on the Cinema Paradiso, both in Fort Lauderdale and its new location in Hollywood. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman. The two theaters are programmed and operated by the renowned Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival and its president and CEO, Gregory von Hausch. For some three decades, he's been a staunch voice for the independent cinema. And more, literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez of Miami-Dade College interviews Pulitzer Prize winner John Meacham. He's written the ultimate biography of the first President George Bush, It's Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George H.W. Bush. Topical Currents up next after the news. Six minutes after one, welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joe has the day off. He returns tomorrow. We begin with a longtime leader of the crusade for the Broward County independent cinema scene. I'd say the independent cinema scene in general. He's the president and CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, Gregory von Hausch, who also programs and operates the Cinema Paradisos in Fort Lauderdale and now in Hollywood. Welcome to you, Gregory.
Thanks, Bonnie. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So how was the party, the 88th Academy Awards party at Sunday night?
We do a great job there. It's really because of we have this great staff that just loves to do it. So they deck the whole thing out. Michelle Filippi, who's our operations director, had prizes, red carpet stanchions.
I've been to a couple.
And we have it up on the big screen, which is 30-foot high def, and then we have it out in our courtyard as well. So it's really cool.
So is anybody from FLIF involved in any way with the Oscars?
With the actual Academy Awards?
Yes, Academy Awards. Okay.
No, but we did have one of our filmmakers had a film. Courtney Marsh was up for Oscar. She's a Fort Lauderdale girl, and she did Chow Beyond the Lines about the kid that suffers from Agent Orange from the thing.
Oh, right.
Fabulous film.
And did she win?
She didn't win, but we think she's a winner anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Well, were you happy with this year's nominees and winners?
You know, I don't know if I've ever said I'm happy with them. I recently saw Room. I thought that film may be the best of the best.
Which is one of the smaller ones.
It was one of the smaller ones, but boy, what a performance and just the great writing. Two performances. The little boy is just phenomenal. So if you haven't seen Room, and also we have right now playing at our fest, Cinema Paradiso Lauderdale, we have Son of Saul, which did win the best foreign language film.
Okay. Well, talk about the current state of indie cinema. You know, we'll get to Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival and, of course, the Cinema Paradisos. But what is the state of it right now around the world and in South Florida?
Well, it's gone through a really roller coaster type of existence. You know, when I came on board back when Miramax was giving us films and festivals were the highlight, the cinema, independent cinema, was just getting going in so many ways in the late 80s. Then thanks to DVDs and everything, they've had a resurgence in the ability to make a film with very low budget on your cell phone,
right.
Has helped. But they still face those tremendous obstacles of marketing budgets, getting to the right people once they get their film made, getting it seen by someone. So I think it's always going to be a struggle for them, but there's so many more ways for them to exhibit the films. That's really come a long way since the 80s.
So what are the challenges that you're facing now getting bodies in chairs?
Well, one of the challenges is the advent of plasma and screens in homes,
right,
and
right.
People, you know, virtually when I get home, which is not so hard to do, but when I do get home, I just want to plant myself because I'm so tired. So what we try to do is do more than just show a movie and sell popcorn. We try to make it an event where there's a speaker For a film where there's something peripheral that'll happen outside before it, Q&A afterwards. Try to tie it into different things. Use music, slides, whatever we can do. And that, I love that. And Cinema Paradiso is known for that because we do so many different events like the Oscars and the Super Bowl parties and different things. And when the election comes up on...
What are you going to do?
We do it. We show it there. We have for the last two since 2008, I think, was the first one. I can't remember which was... If it was 2008 or... But we stay up all night and watch election returns. And, you know, we say... You can cheer your guy, but don't come in with, you know, and don't make this a thing. Just watch it and see it on the big screen. And so that's what we've done. And it's really phenomenal, the experience there.
And it's sort of a bipartisan affair?
To some degree, you know, art cinema seems to tend slightly to the left. And I think probably if we had to take a straw vote.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so one thing I don't know, and maybe many of our listeners, you have Cinema Paradiso's in Hollywood now, and Fort Lauderdale was the original one, and we'll talk about the history of it, but what is the relationship between the Cinema Paradiso's and Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival?
Well, under the moniker of the Broward County Film Society, which is our legal name, we produce the Fort Lauderdale Film Festival, Cinema Paradiso, and Fliff on Location, which goes all over Florida and to the Bahamas. So those are all three entities underneath the Broward County Film Society.
Okay.
So it's really the same people. Like, we have a very small staff. There's about 12 of us spinning pie plates. And so that's kind of how it all is. So this is these Cinema Paradiso are our two year-round art cinemas that we program.
And you know, how is Cinema Paradiso doing? I'm thinking the fact that you opened up in Hollywood is a good sign. How long has that been there now?
We opened up October 19th, 2013. And yes, we turned a big corner this year in paying off all of our construction debt. Just as we were going to open the theater, of course, the mandate came down where there's no more film per se. Nothing's on 35 millimeters. So we all had to be DCP, which is digital cinema projection. And that system cost us roughly $55,000 for each theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a big chunk of change and put in the seats and everything that we had to do in both locations, really.
How are you funded?
We're funded through our membership is a great way. We have about 1,800 members that pay an annual fee, and they get different varying benefits. We're also funded by the state. We're one of the top rated, in fact, this year I think the highest rated film festival in Florida. We're funded by Broward County through the Cultural Tourism Project and through the major cultural institution, of which there are six in Broward County. We're one of those.
And the levels of membership vary, is that right?
Yes.
So what are the levels?
We have a student membership, which is $35, which is pretty reasonable for a calendar year. So it would be 365 days from the day you join. We have our production assistant, which is around $90. And then we have director memberships, which is around $150. And then producers, which is around 300, and executive producers,
okay,
500, and then superstars, which is about 1,000. And there's different benefits for each. And you could go online at fliff.com, F-L-I-F-F.com, and see about all of those.
Okay. And, well, let's go back a little to the history of Cinema Paradiso, the actual building itself and its origins as an art house and home of Fliff.
Right. Well, when I started with Fliff in 1989, we were very nomadic. We would get free office space for 12 months, 13 months, and then we'd have to get up and move when they rented it. So my first 4 or 5 years, we just were moving constantly. It seemed like we had camels in the back parking lot. So in 1998, I approached the county saying, you have the Vinette Carroll Theater. And Vinette was a close friend of mine, but it's never open. And Vinette was very much into the process and not the performance. She loved to rehearse and things like that, and the doors were very rarely open at all. So the county said, if you could be co-tenants with them, we'll let you have that as a cinema. So that was the idea. We would go to cinema, we'd create Cinema Paradiso and Vinette Carroll. And then in 2002, she passed away, and we just assumed the whole ownership, even though it's owned by the county, of the building.
Oh, it is owned by the county.
Right.
It was a church.
It was a church. And then in the 60s, it became a depot for the courthouse, which is like right next door.
Right.
They have court records there. And it was something out of a, you know, Silence of the Lambs type of movie where it's all dusty and light peering through the stained glass windows. And nothing actually happened there except for court records. So in 1986, Vinette Carroll came along and the county said, great, we'll raise a bunch of money. You can make a repertory theater here. And that's what they did. But by the time we got into it in 1998, it was in really disrepair. In fact, it wasn't even code compliant. We had to raise about $1.5 million to renovate it over the next 10 years. And that's what we've done. And now we've opened the second Cinema Paradiso in Hollywood. And we really created that in less than 3 months. So it was quite an operation to get it off the ground.
What an accomplishment.
Yeah.
So what was the mission of Cinema Paradiso when it first opened? And is it the same today?
Yes. The mission, what we wanted to do is, the festival is a finite period during the year. But we would,
I'll just say it's November 4th through 20th this
right,
year.
Right, yes, exactly. Okay. This year, our 31st year, November 4th through 20. And I have payroll and staff, and I used to have them go off the books, you know, and they would not work again until September, getting ready to the festival. And so every year it was a challenge to find people to fill those roles. So I said, if we could keep them going with a year-round art house theater, it would save us time, money, training, and also employ them, which is what they all wanted. So that was really the mission. And we also thought, having an art house cinema, we could drive memberships. We'd have year-round benefits and events going on. And so that was kind of the reason behind it. And I also want to say that you generously mentioned me as the programmer of Cinema Paradiso at the beginning, but it's really programmed by Bonnie Lee Adams, who's our senior programmer since 1995, and Robbie Rosenberg, who a lot of people know from the Miami Gay and Lesbian Festival that he founded, and the Coral Gables Cinema, which he founded. And but now he's been working with us for about a year and a half, I think, and it's been going great.
We're talking with the president and CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, better known as FLIF. That's Gregory von Hausch, and of course, Cinema Paradiso's. And if you have a comment or question for him, or just some kudos, our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. A short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Thank you, Paul Leary, to today's topical currents. Gregory von Hausch with us, president and CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, and of course the Cinema Paradiso's. And FLIF is celebrating 31 years, November 4th through 20th of this year.
Right. It feels like 131.
But you don't look that old. Right. So for those who don't know Cinema Paradiso, let's start with the one in Fort Lauderdale. Just describe it. If they're not familiar with
Sure.
the physical space, describe it and why it's such an incredible place to do all the things you do there.
Well, the reason why it's called Cinema Paradiso is because of the Italian Oscar-winning film,
right.
And it was a church. So when renovated it into a 250-seat stadium seating, plush seats that we bought in Cannes, France, and digital projection, a full bar, inside and out. We have a huge canopied courtyard that we do receptions and parties and press interviews in, and we have a free parking garage right across the street. It's really a jewel. It is so, it's cute.
It is.
Yeah,
it is. And the seats are really comfortable.
Right. They're so comfortable you could fall asleep if the movie's bad.
Which is not. Yeah. That doesn't happen.
No, it does not happen.
And what about the one in Hollywood?
In Hollywood, we have it's a treasure in that it's a small gem. It's a very intimate, but it's got state-of-the-art sound and projection. It's only 82 seats. It serves beer and wine. It's right in the heart of Hollywood Boulevard in the Art and Entertainment District, 2008 Hollywood Boulevard. And there's free parking for the first 3 hours on the street in Hollywood. And I'll give you a hint, too, a little clue here. If you park at 5 o'clock, you can park free all night long.
Because, oh.
Yeah, so that's a great idea. And it's a wonderful place if you want to go out to dinner. We have great restaurants, probably 60, 70 different ethnic restaurants, all within a 5-minute walk of us.
Yeah, it's a great area. Yeah. Hector wants to ask you something. Hector, welcome to Topical Currents.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate Tropical Currents. Always listening to it when I'm driving from the office. I'm a member with my wife. We're part of the younger demographics for the Cinema Paradiso Spectacular Experience for a bottle of wine, $11, and a movie. Italian events that we've done. What we would love to see is that the membership or the staff go over to get a younger membership, because we always feel that we're the youngest in the bunch and we have a great time, but we would love to see 25, the 30-year-old, the 35-year-old that just don't know if this gem is in Fort Lauderdale for everyone, so that we could just be part of the community when we're 60 or 70 and you're still around.
Well, hey. Hector, how would you suggest Gregory go about that?
I think you need to go maybe to the colleges in downtown, FAU's there, Boca College, and just shake those students up. We have a lot of creative students and creative people around, and that's what we should drag them in the creative areas so that you can show them a creative outlet, because the food is always spectacular. The staff is awesome. And where else can you buy a bottle of wine for $11 or $12 and a ticket and a bag of popcorn for less than $25? That's a college date right there, you know?
Hector, that's great. I love your enthusiasm, and I echo it. I think it's a terrific idea. We do have a problem in Fort Lauderdale, is that the younger generation does seem to gravitate toward the bar scene more, and we certainly don't want to get rid of our lifeblood, which is people that have come down from metropolitan areas with a history of cinema. But you're exactly right. We do work exceptionally well with the Art Institute. They're, in fact, they're designing our poster this year. We, on top of that, we have a good relationship with Broward College, where our opening night film will be. And but having said all that, you're exactly right. And feel free to email me any suggestions you might have. It's greg@fliff.com, greg@fliff.com.
Awesome. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate you guys.
Okay, thanks so much. I wanted to ask you if there's any volunteer opportunities there. I know you have you said 12 people,
right,
total staff, but do you have volunteer opportunities, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, we do, nightly. In fact, we actually attract kids that are in high school that will help us with everything from the parking garage, because they got to do service hours. We have a lot of college students, and we have a lot of retirees. And Janet Schwartz and Aaron Fontes, our managing director. Janet's our volunteer coordinator. They are always putting it out. And if you go on our website, fliff.com, they'll have things there that you can click on for information about volunteering.
Okay. I wanted to ask how you get your movies. I know you said who programs it, but do you pay less than, say, you know, a big movie chain theater would pay?
Unfortunately not. Now, during the festival, when I get a film for the festival, those will be free. And they use the festival as a marketing tool. But throughout the year, like Son of Saul is a very expensive film, and 45 Years that we just closed was very expensive. We pay a percentage, which is the best way to do it, because if nobody came.
Oh, okay.
But the fact is that people
are. It's by head?
It's by, percentage of the tickets. And, but Yeah, it's an expensive thing when you think about the overhead for the building. I mentioned before that the Paradiso in Fort Lauderdale is free. Well, it's an old building, 1926, and it's a money pit. So just keeping the air conditioning and plumbing and going is, it's an expensive proposition. That's why our corporate sponsors and our membership is so important to us.
Peter wants to know why there isn't more support from the city, for example, noting theater on the marquee in Young Circle.
Yes. They have been supportive. The city's been very supportive. We wouldn't be there without them financially, because they made a 10-year contribution to us if we would go in and create Cinema Paradiso Hollywood. In fact, I should give credit to the Community Redevelopment Agency in Hollywood. They're the ones that put the whole thing together why we're there. To answer his question, we've had the same issues that we're trying to get resolved, but they're supportive. They take my phone calls.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about FLIFF, the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. Just a little history of it and who you partner with.
Sure. As I mentioned before, this is our 31st year. I came on in 1989, and I've been there ever since. Looking for retirement soon. And we partner with Broward County as the cultural division there. It's just been fantastic. I know you guys have Jody Leshensky on here regularly.
On the South Florida Arts Beat.
On the Arts Beat. And we partner with them. Also, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, which houses the film liaison office that Noel Stevenson VP of, and we work with them. We work with the schools and the businesses and the colleges, and we try to make the festival. When I was growing up as a kid, the word festival, I go to these Italian street fairs, and that was a festival for me because there was something going around me 360 degrees, in front, back, music, smells, lights, everything.
Right.
So I've tried to emulate that experience as a child to be our festival. So we'd always have something going on something new and different. And that's what I think about our festival. It's a very user-friendly festival. People can come in and they can buy a ticket and meet the filmmakers. They don't have to be an uppity-up. They'll be there. Everybody's welcome. And afterwards, in the courtyard, everybody files into it and meets everybody. So it's a very friendly festival, and we say that to all of our filmmakers as well.
And what kind of economic impact does the festival have in Broward?
It's right now where our budget is just under $2 million, and according to studies that have done by University of South Florida and also some recently through the University of Florida, the multiplier is at $16.2 for every dollar invested in us. So right now we're around $32 million impact for Broward County, and that is year round, of course. And we feel really good about that. We're the top tourist related project for Broward Cultural Division and putting heads in beds, and we feel good about that as well.
So we have another emailer. You mentioned area restaurants. Ever thought of partnering with them, talking about the Hollywood Cinema Paradiso, offering dinner and movie deals such as tabletop cards in restaurants?
We printed up a dinner and a movie, and you can go to several restaurants in Hollywood, ask for their dinner and a movie special, and get tickets, which will include tickets to Cinema Paradiso for $5.
So is that listed on your website?
They're listed in the actual, we printed up little table tents and also tickets that they put in with your bill when they break it to you.
Okay. We don't have too much longer, but
could I tell everybody what's playing?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I want you to do.
Well, that, right now, I mentioned we have Son of Saul at Fort Lauderdale. In Hollywood, we're playing this Icelandic black comedy called Rams, which is just hysterical and very off-the-wall comedy. They're so dark comedy and from Iceland. Opening on March 4th, we have the Peruvian mystery film, The Vanished Elephant, starring Angie Cepeda, who's an actress who's come to our festival. And we also have the Romanian award-winning film, Affirm. And then on March 11th, Embrace This of the Serpent, which is the Colombian Oscar entry, will open. And on the 18th, we have Rabin, the documentary about the assassination of the Israeli prime minister. And in Fort Lauderdale, there's a fabulous comedy called My Name is Doris with Sally Field, and that opens on the 18th.
Well, all that, your whole schedule, if you go to fliff.com, we can see the whole schedule,
right? And you can sign up for our newsletter. Just go on newsletter and put your email there, and you'll get a weekly e-blast from us.
I saw in your bio, you were a theater person. I mean, it said that you've been an actor, director, writer, and producer of theater.
Right.
So how did you make the transition?
I created and founded the Hippodrome State Theater in Gainesville, and I was there as 15 years as artistic director. And during that time, we had a very cinematic approach to theater. We did the stage adaptations of They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, Carnal Knowledge, Next Stop Greenwich Village, Tiger Tail. We worked with Tennessee Williams, Paul Mazursky, Eric Bentley,
wow,
and quite a few. So we always had that cinematic approach. And this is back in the 70s when there wasn't DVDs, so I was doing things even before VHS players.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have Gregory Von Hausch. He's the president and CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, FLIFF, and the Cinema Paradisos. And formerly, he was involved in the world of theater, founded the Hippodrome State Theater in Gainesville. And FLIFF is celebrating 31 years from November 4th to 20th. And again, the website is?
FLIFF.com, FLIFF.com.
Okay, well, Gregory, see you at the movies. Thanks so much for being with
us. Oh, thanks, Bonnie. It's been great.
Thank you. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. John Meacham's new biography, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George H.W. Bush, is a fascinating, exhausting look at the 41st president, whose single term in office was remarkably eventful. Tiananmen Square, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the U.S. invasion of Panama, the Gulf War, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, all took place while Bush sat in the Oval Office. A pragmatist, Bush was willing to strike deals with the Democrats to pass meaningful legislation. This often put him in the crosshairs of the right wing of his party, which longed for a visionary ideologue like Bush's predecessor, Ronald Reagan. Although granted complete access by Bush, Meacham does not ignore his faults. Overall, however, he paints a positive portrait of the former president, a decent, reliable, steady leader who was conservative in the best sense of the word. He tried to make the machinery of government work better, not dismantle it. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Meacham about his new book. He began by asking him how President Bush compromised his values to achieve political success.
Well, he saw compromise as utilitarian, not as cynical. His view was that once he was in power, putting the national interest ahead of his own short-term political interest was the right thing to do. Which he explicitly did, for instance, in the 1990 budget agreement that raised taxes, breaking his campaign pledge of 2 years before. And the justification was that circumstances had changed. The right thing to do was to agree to higher taxes, alienating the right wing of his own party. And for him, it was a matter of what he once called sound governance versus politics.
Yes, certainly breaking his tax pledge was a noble change of mind. There are other instances in his career where he, to put it crudely, he lay down with dogs and picked up some fleas. For example, in 1964, when he was running for the Senate in Texas, he was opposed to the Civil Rights Act and Medicare, even though in his heart he wasn't really opposed to those things. What was he?
No, he wasn't. And once he got power, that is, once he was elected to Congress 2 years later, and then in 1968, he voted for fair housing, which lifted racial discrimination from the housing market. He's not a perfect man. He is a political creature, someone who wanted to win political office, wanted to shape the lives of others. And so his pattern was to take positions in campaigns that were farther to the right than he was genuinely comfortable with, and then reverting to a more centrist position once he was actually in office.
Yes, but once he actually reverted to a centrist position, he came under fire from the right, from the right wing. How did he deal with that?
Poorly, to be honest. The politics we have now, with a very, very conservative base of the Republican Party, took shape in the administration of George H.W. Bush in rebellion, really, against their own, a president of their own party. Newt Gingrich explicitly broke with the president in order to build a congressional majority, and that wounded President Bush politically a very great deal. But, you know, to my mind, what ultimately redeems his life is his political life, is the fact that when the chips were really down, he did what he thought was right for the broader whole than for his own base or his own political future. And he paid a steep price for it. Pat Buchanan got into the 1992 primaries in part because Bush had decided to take a centrist position. Ross Perot capitalized on that in 1992. And in no small measure, Bush was a one-term president because his own right wing ultimately distrusted him.
We're speaking with John Meacham about his new biography of former President George H.W. Bush. It's called Destiny and Power. There's an interesting quote in your book. It's from Vin Weber, who's a now retired congressman, but at the time he was, when President Bush was president, he was in the House of Representatives. And he said, after the controversy over reneging on the tax pledge, or the no new tax pledge, he said, "What is good for the president may well be good for the country, but it is not necessarily good for congressional Republicans." That was 25 years ago. Have things changed?
It's gotten worse even from that, I think. I think you've seen a hardening of ideological positions on both left and right in a way that makes progress on legislation that can affect people's lives all too difficult. What George H.W. Bush managed to accomplish is all the more remarkable, I think, when you think about the fact that these ideological categories were growing ever firmer. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act of 1990, the budget agreement we've discussed, these were all pretty big pieces of legislation that expanded the role of the public sector. And Bush, as a Republican, was able to do some legislative things that for which he got very little credit, largely because conservatives didn't particularly approve of them and Democrats didn't want to give a Republican president credit. I think that, honestly, that George H.W. Bush, the more time passes, the better he looks, because he was able, despite these cross currents of ideology, to improve a number of people's lives, despite the fact that his own party was against him on a good number of them.
Well, when I read your book, I thought that you made him sound like the most significant one-term president since James Knox Polk. And since you're from Tennessee, I think you can appreciate that.
I do indeed. And I think he was. I think that's a fair statement. I also think that when you take into account foreign policy, you have a one-term president who had enough happen to him that could have encompassed two terms. I mean, you had the Gulf War. You had the end of the Soviet Union, the reunification of Germany. You know, one of the things that is ironic and sad about politics and history is often you don't get credit for keeping bad things from happening. And George Bush was very much about trying to keep bad things from happening, trying to maximize the odds that some good things could happen in our public square.
Well, his relationship with Ronald Reagan, because he did serve as Ronald Reagan's vice president for 8 years, Reagan did not want him to be his vice president, did he?
No, not at all. In fact, he was a distant second choice to, of all people, Gerald Ford, the former president, whom Reagan had challenged in 1976 for the Republican nomination. For 3 long days in the Detroit Republican National Convention in 1980, Reagan attempted to strike a deal with Ford that would lure Ford back onto the ticket, back into Washington. So it wasn't until the penultimate night of the convention that Reagan reached out to Bush, asked him to be on the ticket. And at that point, Bush and Reagan, I think, based on the evidence, formed an affectionate relationship, as affectionate as Ronald Reagan could be with anyone who wasn't his wife. And that Bush had a fairly consequential vice presidency, at least in terms of foreign policy.
Well, Bush certainly proved himself after Reagan's assassination attempt. He acquitted himself admirably. What did he do that impressed others?
Well, it's important to remember that the assassination attempt came on March 3rd, 1981. So the Reagan administration had not been in office for 100 days yet. And there had been an enormous amount of chaos in the Situation Room at the White House while Reagan was at the hospital. Bush was on his way back from Texas, where he'd been traveling, and came into the room sort of like Fortinbras at the end of Hamlet, and restored a sense of order. In particular, he declined to and insisted that he not land dramatically on the South Lawn in the presidential helicopter to sort of reassert authority. He wanted to come in quietly with a kind of steadiness and a kind of grace. And Reagan always appreciated that Bush did not attempt to grandstand or showboat or grab too much attention for himself at that difficult hour.
That's the good side of his vice presidency. I think the dark side or the bad side of his vice presidency was Iran-Contra, where he claimed that he was not in the loop with the decision to sell arms to Iran for hostages. But he was in the loop, wasn't he?
He was certainly in the loop. He approved of the operation. He had certain reservations because it was being done through Israel, but for all intents and purposes, he understood the policy. He understood how it was being implemented. And though George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, opposed the policy, Bush and Reagan, among others, supported it. And so the assertion that he was not in the loop was a very Talmudic one, if you will, because he was not in the operational loop, as he put it. But for all intents and purposes, he understood what was going on, not with the diversion to the Contras, but with regard to Iran.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with John Meacham. This is Eric Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is biographer John Meacham, whose new book, Destiny and Power, is a look at the life of former President George H.W. Bush. Mr. Meacham, the 1992 election, the one where Bill Clinton defeated George H.W. Bush, Mr. Bush was very sick that year, wasn't he?
He was. He was suffering from a condition called Graves' disease. In fact, he still suffers from it. It's something that you manage but do not cure, which affects your thyroid, which affects almost everything about you. And his treatment and dosage for the Graves' disease was such that it kept his energy levels at a lower level than they ordinarily were. So a lot of people who saw him as subject to lassitude, a kind of an uncharacteristic lack of acuity, a kind of detachment, has at least something to do with the fact that his thyroid was not operating at full speed.
Well, your book has got a lot of attention because of Mr. Bush's comments about his son and Vice President Cheney. It's now introduced the term iron ass into the American political lexicon. What does Mr. Bush think was iron ass about his son's administration?
He worried that the tone of the 43 administration, that he was closer to his son on substance than people appreciate. but he was skeptical of the swaggering style of the Bush-Cheney administration. And by iron ass, he meant inflexible, undiplomatic. And he simply believed that Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld had not served the president well by acting more unilaterally. He held his son to a personal account for saying axis of evil. He thought that was an undiplomatic phrase and would not, as he put it, might not be seen to be historically benefiting anything. So the disagreements were about the hawkish image of the United States in the years of the second Iraq War.
Well, I found it interesting that Dick Cheney was not Bush's first choice for defense secretary. He had gone with a Republican senator who was not accepted by the U.S. Senate, was not approved. And then he went with Cheney. And by appointing Cheney as defense secretary, that allowed Newt Gingrich to become the House Minority Leader and therefore come to the front of the political stage. The relationship with Donald Rumsfeld, however, was something much more toxic. They don't get along, do they? And they haven't gone along for many years.
No, they had not. They were young rivals in the age of Nixon and Ford. They had circled around each other for a number of years. And there had always been a long-time legend that Rumsfeld had maneuvered Bush into being director of the CIA to remove Bush from the national political scene. I find a more complicated story behind all of that. But there's no question that Rumsfeld was one of those few people in public life who did not get along with George H.W. Bush, either in real time or during the son's administration.
You mentioned Bush's tenure as CIA director. He was CIA director for 1 year. And he was instrumental in establishing something called Team B. Could you tell us what Team B was?
Team B was a group of largely conservative analysts who were allowed to come in and create a competitive piece of analysis. Every year, the CIA produces something called the National Intelligence Estimate, which is supposed to guide policymakers in terms of defense spending and defense priorities. And the conservative community thought that the CIA had for a long time underestimated Soviet intentions and strength. And so Bush, under some pressure, decided to allow a conservative group to produce their own analysis, which unsurprisingly produced a very hawkish national intelligence estimate draft or report. And one of the ironies is that many of those, or several of those people who were involved with Team B, including Paul Wolfowitz, ultimately became hawks in the war on terror later under his son.
We're speaking with John Meacham about his new biography of George H.W. Bush, Destiny and Power. And I find it also somewhat ironic that his son, Jeb Bush, who's running for president, is getting hit so hard from the right. And, of course, no one can ever say Jeb Bush is a progressive. And yet he's getting hit so hard from the right, despite everything that the family has done to placate or to appease the right wing.
It's true. It's a half-century story. 1963, Mrs. Bush wrote, Barbara Bush wrote in her diary that the nuts would never love her husband, and she was right. The family has long struggled with this tension between a more moderate appearance and the more conservative, the ever more conservative base of the Republican Party. George W. Bush complicates that story a bit because he was always seen as someone who was more in line with the base than the father or Governor Bush. I do think you're right. The Governor Bush right now is suffering more in the fashion of his father than of his brother, in that the base, which, as I say, grows ever more conservative and ever more populist, is looking at him quite warily.
Well, the portrait you paint of President Bush is certainly estimable. He is a basically very decent man who has a slavish devotion towards public service, a dedicated family man. And in his personal life, perhaps the great tragedy is the death of his daughter. Tell us about that.
In 1953, Barbara and George Bush lost a daughter named Robin to leukemia. Neither parent had ever heard the word, interestingly, until they heard the diagnosis. She struggled with the cancer for about 6 months or so, and then died in October of 1953. It shaped their lives, as one would expect. It was a terrible tragedy. And when I asked President Bush what he had taken away from the experience, he said that it had taught him that life was unpredictable and fragile, unpredictable and fragile. And I think that helps explain his own drive, his own energy throughout his life, which was that every day was a gift, that at any point it could be taken away. This combined with his experience in World War II when he lost two crewmen, when he was shot down over the Pacific, I think gave him an appreciation for the fragility of things in a way that very few people appreciated when he was in the public eye.
I found it very touching that Barbara and George Bush will be buried next to Robin, won't they?
They will be buried with Robin in a little grove of trees near his presidential library in College Station, Texas. They brought her from Greenwich some years ago where she had been buried, and that will be where they will lie forever.
Prescott Bush, George H.W. Bush's father, there's been a lot of controversy over him, and yet as a U.S. senator, he was quite moderate, wasn't he?
Prescott Bush was a moderate to liberal Republican at a time when that was not an oxymoron. He was fairly moderate on civil rights. He supported the Interstate Highway Act. He was someone who opposed Joseph McCarthy and McCarthyite tactics. So he was someone very much from the center, even the center-left part of the Republican Party of the Eisenhower era.
And he was a friend of President Eisenhower. And I find it interesting that President Eisenhower was a very successful two-term Republican president, is never invoked by Republicans at their convention or on the campaign trail. The only Republican president they ever mention is the fellow from California from the 1980s. They don't even mention that strange man from Illinois from the 1860s. Why is Eisenhower kind of persona non grata in the Republican Party?
Well, movement conservatism, as it's known, which is, in fact, the governing ideology of Reaganism, really grew out of reaction to the Eisenhower administration. Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, and Newt Gingrich, ultimately, and we see this with several Republicans today, they defined themselves in opposition to Eisenhower, and they were upset and alienated by Eisenhower's failure to significantly uproot the New Deal and Fair Deal policies of Roosevelt and Truman. Eisenhower was a different kind of conservative. He was a classical conservative in the sense that he took the world as it was and modestly reformed it where he could. He was not a revolutionary. Reagan was at least rhetorically a revolutionary, though in fact federal spending grew under President Reagan, which is an inconvenient fact that people don't like to talk about, conservatives don't like to talk about. But Eisenhower is a lost figure in the Republican Party, I think because he's a moderate figure. My own view is that George H.W. Bush was functionally the last Eisenhower Republican. And as you point out, it's striking that people have consigned him to a kind of Republican oblivion, given his success and given his two terms.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with John Meacham.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. He reviews books for the Miami Herald. We thank you for tuning in this hour. Our cinema segment was produced by Polly Landis. Our lead producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by our online producer, Paul Leary. You can go to our website, WLRN.org, for more information and for free audio downloads. And more links and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Joe's back tomorrow when we speak with investigative reporter Rick Shankman, who's written Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great afternoon. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.